From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Florida voters will decide the legality of abortion during the upcoming election.
It's going to depend on how much the Biden campaign and his allies are going to pump in to make this issue stick.
Also this week, a recreational marijuana initiative likewise makes it to this November's ballot, much to the delight of proponents.
Cannabis has lower adverse consequences than alcohol.
We'll also chat with a third-party presidential candidate and explore yet another economic setback for a North Florida county already reeling from a major factory shutdown. I'm Tom Flanagan, online and on air. This is Capitol Report and the end-of-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. Democrats in the Southeast are setting up abortion as a major election issue after the Florida Supreme Court released two opinions on Monday that could change the landscape of abortion access in the region. Regan McCarthy reports.
At the same time, Florida justices triggered a 6-week abortion ban by upholding the state's current 15-week restrictions. The court okayed ballot language for a proposed amendment that lets voters decide whether to explicitly protect abortion access in the state constitution.
Floridians now face a near total abortion ban that eliminates the option to pursue care before many women even know they're pregnant.
Florida House Democratic leader Fentress Driscoll blames former President Donald Trump for creating an atmosphere she says allowed the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade in 2022, handing abortion decisions to individual states. Driscoll says that led to the Florida Supreme Court's recent decision that she says threatens the health and lives of women in Florida and across the South.
Women have already been forced to flee the state for medical care or suffer without it after an already dangerous ban was signed into law in 2022. We can only expect more of that now.
Driscoll joined Democrats from Georgia and North Carolina in a press call with President Joe Biden's reelection campaign to talk about the impact a 6-week abortion ban in Florida will have throughout the region. Right now, Florida is one of the few states in the Southeast that allows abortion after 6 weeks. Soon, North Carolina's 12-week ban will make that state the closest place for many people in the Southeast to access abortion. But North Carolina's Democratic Governor Roy Cooper says the state's clinics are stretched thin as it is.
We now expect even more women will be traveling to North Carolina, desperate to get the care that they need.
During the call, representatives from Biden's campaign said abortion could put Florida in play as a battleground state in November. Daniel Smith, a political science professor at the University of Florida, says there are a lot of factors that could impact the state of Democrats in Florida. For example, more Republicans are now registered in Florida than Democrats. But he says the abortion issue combined with a recreational marijuana initiative that will also be on the ballot in November give Democrats and President Biden a, quote, glimmer of hope in Florida.
Ballot measures both can mobilize people to the polls who might not normally come out, but they can also persuade people. They have these educative effects, and those may not be as pronounced in presidential campaigns and presidential elections, but they certainly are present.
Smith says the proposals could benefit Democrats in two ways, by increasing voter turnout, but also by causing candidates to take a stance on issues important to voters and giving voters a chance to think about which candidate best represents their beliefs. Smith says he doesn't think it's a coincidence that an abortion amendment is heading to the ballot in Florida at the same time as a presidential election.
Will it work is another question. It's going to depend on how much the Biden campaign and his allies are going to pump in to make this issue stick to the candidates and make it a choice that is not just about foreign policy, say, or the deficit or other types of issues like immigration, but make it about reproductive rights first, foremost, and center.
Meanwhile, Lauren Brinzell, who is the campaign director for Floridians Protecting Freedom, the group behind the proposed amendment, says abortion isn't a Republican or Democrat issue. Brinzell says it's an issue for people who want to keep decisions about their health care between their families and their doctors.
The fact is, we can never know what someone else is going through. We're not in their shoes. That's why we must vote yes on this amendment to keep the government out of our exam rooms and make sure Florida families and the doctors who treat them can make the decisions that are right for them.
The proposed amendment, known as Amendment 4, could reverse the 6-week ban that's set to go into effect at the beginning of next month. If the amendment passes in November, Brinzell says it will go into effect in January of next year. To pass, it needs approval from at least 60% of voters who turn out at the polls. More than 1 million people signed petitions to get the proposed amendment on the ballot, and Brinzell says the next step will require even broader support.
Florida is a large state, and we need to make sure that we reach out to voters all across this very large state who come from a variety of different backgrounds.
Immediately after the court ruled, Florida Republican House Speaker Paul Renner spoke to journalists and called the amendment extreme. He said he plans to fight it, starting by targeting people he says are in the middle.
But when you dig into this amendment, they would find it to be far, far more extreme than anything else really in the country and even around the world.
The key language in the proposed amendment reads, "No law shall prohibit, penalize, delay, or restrict abortion before viability or when necessary to protect the patient's health as determined by the patient's health care provider." It includes one exception for parental notification when minors seek an abortion, a stipulation which is already in the state constitution. I'm Regan McCarthy.
Florida voters will also get to decide this November whether they want to allow recreational marijuana in the state. The state Supreme Court approved language on Monday for a ballot initiative that would change the state constitution to allow the sale and consumption of cannabis for Floridians over 21. Trulieve, the largest medical cannabis company in the state, was the main financial supporter behind getting the issue on the ballot. Kim Rivers, the company's CEO, spoke with Tristan Wood about the push to legalize recreational pot and how its adoption would affect the medical industry.
Six more medical marijuana companies are joining the push for Amendment 3 and has raised fundraising for it for over $15 million. What does that mean in terms of what the push for this ballot initiative is going to look like?
Yeah, I mean, we are absolutely thrilled that other companies have joined in with dollars to join us in the fight for Amendment 3. And really, it's critical at this stage as we turn the page and move from getting on the ballot to now our focus will be on, of course, voter education. Using data and science, some of which I think is going to be new to some folks. So I'm really thrilled that we've got some additional supporters, and we'll be able to broaden that that education campaign to reach as many Floridians as possible.
Gotcha. And what's going to be some of those messages that you want voters to understand about cannabis and understand about the amendment?
Some of us who maybe are a little bit older remember the sort of just say no campaigns of yesteryears, and there's been a lot of propaganda around marijuana in particular for a number of years. So for us to be able to really talk about that in a more specific way, for example, the FDA just released a report on cannabis specifically, where they compared cannabis to a number of other substances, and interestingly, including alcohol, and really concluded that cannabis has lower adverse consequences than alcohol. And that's backed by broad data set and extensive research. So 41 states in the country have some form of medical program. And then layered on top of that, right, 24 of those 41 states also have an adult use program. And so the science and the data is there now, right? We don't have to have conjecture leading the conversation. It really should be grounded in fact.
On that issue, what's going to happen to the medical cannabis marketplace if the adult use marketplace is approved by voters?
No, absolutely. We would anticipate that, the medical market would, and it's actually a priority of ours to ensure that the medical market does continue. It's really important for us and certainly for me as a leader. You know, we've made a commitment to those medical patients who rely on us, candidly, for their products. So I'm quite certain that that will remain. I think an important point here, and one that will be a differentiator and something that, you know, will be addressed upon implementation with the legislature, is we fully expect for adult use cannabis to be taxed. The medical program currently is not taxed. And so we do also believe that that will be a continuing driver for folks to continue to you know, go and see their doctor and get their medical card and maintain that status. You know, it also could be that there are differentials in product as well. And so, again, we would expect that that medical market would continue.
Some current legislative leaders have been critical of the ballot initiative, Speaker Paul Renner. One of them, what role do you think the legislature is going to have in the rulemaking process if it passes?
Yeah, I mean, so I think that the legislature absolutely will have a robust role in the rulemaking process. Specifically, the language of the ballot calls out the fact that the legislature is empowered to pass laws and adding specificity around the rollout. And I think there's already some misinformation that's being floated by some folks out there, and, you know, stating and putting false notions that, for example, there would automatically be allowed smoking in public places. I have two middle school children. I absolutely do not want to see and would not be supportive of a marketplace where smoking was allowed, you know, anywhere and everywhere. I would expect absolutely that the legislature come in and place restrictions on public consumption, very similar to what they have done with both alcohol and tobacco.
Gotcha. Is there any other things about the push for the ballot initiative, any other misconceptions that you feel that have been spreading around in the media space about it? Is there anything you want to add?
A couple of things. Thanks for asking. Again, what we're talking about is the creation of a very specifically defined taxed and regulated marketplace where adults who choose to utilize these products have access to safe and clean and tested products, right? We do have, unfortunately, a fentanyl crisis in Florida, and a lot of that comes through illicit cannabis that's available in the black market. And so giving folks an option and then having the opportunity to also generate tax revenue that we can reinvest into our local communities, perhaps even into law enforcement for some of the other things that we just mentioned. So I do think that, again, we have a very robust medical program in the state of Florida. We have an infrastructure in terms of traceability, in terms of, again, a very robust testing laboratory structure, et cetera, that this program would sit on top of. So this isn't, you know, we're not talking about the wild, wild west here. We are talking about a very regulated marketplace that is consistent with, you know, what I call the Florida way.
That was Capital reporter Tristan Wood speaking with Trulieve CEO Kim Rivers. But when it comes to the two constitutional amendments that will appear on the November ballot, never let it be said that Governor Ron DeSantis is a big fan. He's lashed out at both of those proposed constitutional amendments. Just days after the Florida Supreme Court signed off on the measures, one of the ballot initiatives would enshrine abortion rights in the Constitution. The other, as we just heard, would authorize recreational marijuana for people ages 21 and older. That recreational marijuana initiative came after Florida voters in 2016 approved an amendment authorizing medical marijuana. The governor criticized the recreational marijuana measure, which will appear as Amendment 3 on the November ballot, saying it would go beyond decriminalizing marijuana. DeSantis also opposes the abortion amendment, which will appear on the ballot as Amendment 4, calling it very extreme. DeSantis predicted both amendments will fail.
Florida voters over the past 4 or 5 cycles have developed a skepticism on these amendments generally because they're always written in ways that are confusing. You don't necessarily know what the intent's going to be. So I think that there's a certain segment of voters, they default just vote no on these things.
During the past decade, voters have approved high-profile constitutional amendments on issues such as allowing medical marijuana, increasing the minimum wage, and restoring voting rights to felons who have completed their sentences. Coming up on Capitol Report, we'll talk with a third-party candidate for president who isn't happy with the difficulty of qualifying to get on the Florida ballot.
It is not like, you know, magic to wave a wand to get your name on a ballot.
And while Florida is trying to lure more new manufacturing jobs to the state, some longtime production jobs in a rural North Florida county are disappearing forever.
It's just another blow to an area that has already been decimated.
A new national poll shows 3 in 10 voters don't want either Joe Biden or Donald Trump to be president. That would seem to open up the field for third-party candidates, but that's easier said than done, especially in Florida. The third-party presidential candidate now getting the most national attention is Robert F. Kennedy Jr., but he's by no means the only hopeful not connected to either the Democratic or Republican parties. Another candidate vying for the nation's top job is Dennis Andrew Ball.
I am a man of God, and I believe God wants me to do this every day. He said, go the distance. Do what you need to do to get your name out there. Do what you need to do to get the party's name out there. Why? Because if you're not fighting for your family, who are you working for?
Ball calls his party the American Party of America. Its platform includes lower taxes and smaller government, especially the part of government, he says, specializes in separating children from their parents and locking up seniors in nursing homes.
Once the courts get a hold of you, whether it's the criminal court or the civil court or even the probate court and family court, your life more than likely will be turned upside down, shaken down also for your money and property, and possibly even separated from your own children.
But Ball can't hope to attract voters unless he can get on the ballot. He says that's especially hard in Florida.
Florida is a very partisan state. You have Democrats and Republicans. Anybody who's going to be anybody in this state has got to get registered with the Secretary of State.
Leon County Election Supervisor Mark Early admits that registration process is a heavy lift.
By noon on July 15th of 2024, you have to submit at least 145,040 signed petitions to the supervisors of elections from across the state, and you would have to submit them to the supervisor within which that voter resided. And you would also then by August 24th have to submit 30 electors of your minor party who are registered voters in Florida to the Department of State to be your Electoral College votes.
Political scientist Lana Atkison, director of the Leroy Collins Institute at Florida State University, thinks candidate Ball may be onto something in thinking the whole process is tilted in favor of the major parties.
Both Democrats and Republicans are probably favorable towards rules that limit access. Neither party wants a third candidate to peel off those few votes that might make the difference in any election outcome.
But Supervisor Early feels a fairly high qualifications bar is necessary to separate serious candidates from those who just want to see their name on the ballot. And he notes the major party candidates face some pretty stiff qualifiers of their own.
Regular party affiliation candidates have to go through a massive primary system unless you're already the incumbent, in which case you've already had to go through that whole primary process, you know, for president with all the Super Tuesdays and all that kind of thing. So the party candidates have to go through probably bigger hurdles than just collecting 145,000 names to get on the ballot.
While some third-party candidates do make the ballot, no third-party presidential candidates have ever come anywhere near the White House. The closest was Teddy Roosevelt, who in 1912 bested the Republican candidate and took about 27% of the vote with his Bull Moose Party. Political scientist Lana Atkinson says America's political system just isn't set up for that kind of competition.
Third parties really work well, and fourth parties and fifth parties work really well in parliamentary systems because of that proportional vote. You know, whatever proportion you get overall, you get the same number of seats. But here it's district-based, so you know, winner take all. The winner of the districts gets all the representation.
Which is small consolation for folks like Dennis Andrew Ball.
It is not like, you know, magic to wave a wand to get your name on a ballot or even registered with the state of Florida. They all know this. And so it makes it even doubly hard when you're an independent to get your name out there in the political arena.
The last we heard, Ball had filed his paperwork with the Secretary of State's office, and then he filed a lawsuit at the federal courthouse down the street objecting to Florida's ballot qualification requirements. Broward County is finding itself under pressure to divert more money to the county's charter schools. WLRN's Christine DeMonte gets us started on that story.
As a teacher turned state lawmaker, Manny Diaz was known as a leading advocate for charter schools in Tallahassee, and he took thousands of dollars in campaign contributions from the school choice industry. Now, as Florida's Commissioner of Education, Diaz is working to ensure that charter schools get millions of dollars in public funds, money that voters had set aside for Broward County public schools. WLRN's education reporter Kate Payne has been looking into this and joins me now. So, Kate, Broward County Public Schools is under pressure by the State Department of Education, led by Commissioner Manny Diaz, to pay out about $80 million to charter schools. Why is that?
This all goes back to a tax that voters approved back in 2018 to raise millions of dollars for Broward County Public Schools. At the time, the district did not have to share that money with charter schools, which are publicly funded but privately run. Since then, court cases and a new state law have changed this, so now public districts do have to share tax referendum money with charter schools. Now, a group of charters are suing BCPS over what they say they're owed, and Commissioner Manny Diaz and the State Board of Education are not waiting to let those lawsuits play out. Here's Andrew King, an attorney for the State Department of Ed.
Broward currently owes charter schools in its district around $80 million collectively. And because it has yet to pay this money, it is currently not in compliance with state law.
Attorneys for BCPS have been pushing back, saying state officials are overstepping the balance of powers between the courts and the executive branch. Here's Marilyn Batista, the attorney for the Broward School Board.
Because these lawsuits exist and they are in full litigation right now for breach of contract, it seems like it would be a problem to have another branch sort of interfere with the process that is already being set into place.
The State Board of Ed has rejected this argument. And at the board's meeting on March 27th, they formally declared that BCPS is out of compliance with state law and ordered the district to resolve the charter school's complaints by April 17th or face the consequences, which could include withholding state funding. And now, a Broward School Board member is pushing to have Batista, the attorney, fired for her handling of this situation.
You've been looking into the relationship between Commissioner Diaz and the school choice industry. What have you found?
Diaz was a longtime educator before becoming a state lawmaker and then ed commissioner under Governor Ron DeSantis. Diaz spent two decades in Miami-Dade County Public Schools as a teacher and administrator, and then he moved into the charter school space and became closely affiliated with one of the largest charter school networks in the state, Academica. And as a state lawmaker, Diaz was a go-to advocate for school choice efforts. As an elected official, Diaz and his political committee took in tens of thousands of dollars in campaign donations from charter school groups and executives, among many other donors and industries. That's according to a review by Integrity Florida. One repeat donor was Charter Schools USA, which is based in Fort Lauderdale and is the management company that operates a number of the schools now suing BCPS.
Now, has Commissioner Diaz commented on his relationship with the charter industry?
I reached out for comment, and the department issued a statement saying that Diaz has a responsibility to make sure that school districts are following state law, and the State Board of Education has the constitutional authority to oversee school districts. And, quote, to suggest that his positions have been influenced by anything other than his commitment to high-quality educational options for all students is a flat-out lie.
Kate, what does all of this mean for Broward County Public Schools going forward?
District officials and attorneys say they're committed to resolving the lawsuits with the charter schools as soon as possible. But they're negotiating with 87 different charter schools, and they've warned it may not be possible to get that done by April 17th. The State Board of Education will take another look at the issue then, and if they're not satisfied, the State Board could take action, including withholding state funding from Broward schools.
That was WLRN education reporter Kate Payne.
You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, a small rural town in North Florida has lost its last mill. Manufacturing companies in Taylor County say the mills were no longer profitable and needed to close. Adrian Andrews spoke with local and state officials who say hundreds of workers are now out of a job.
West Fraser Sawmill is located right off U.S. Highway 19 and is visible as soon as you enter the town of Perry. The lumber company makes and ships wood products to areas across the state, but there's one problem. The sawmill is no longer open. The company closed the plant last Friday because of, quote, high fiber costs and being in a low-price commodity environment. WFSU drove out to Perry following West Fraser's closure and found that a lot of residents saw this coming.
Devastating news when we heard that West Fraser wasn't going to open up again. It was a blow to us when they closed it.
Taylor County Commissioner Thomas Demp says while the community is upset, no one is surprised by the company's decision. According to a release, West Fraser began letting folks go last year. The company says the sawmill originally started with 126 employees, but last January cut back operations, leaving just a handful of maintenance workers at the facility. But once Georgia-Pacific shut its paper mill down in Perry following Hurricane Idalia, West Fraser decided not to reopen as well.
My family depended on that mill. My dad worked out there for years, and I had a brother to work out there. So it's been around when it was Perry Lumber Company, and it done great. It's been a great asset to this county.
Now that both plants are no longer running, Commissioner Demp says the people of Perry need somewhere to work. He's turning to the county's Development Authority and the State Economic Development Council to help come up with a plan to bring jobs and money back to the agriculture town. He says this is the first time the county has been without a mill in over 100 years.
They're looking for place to go and a place and something to do.
West Fraser hasn't said if it plans to sell the sawmill. However, a company spokesperson says the equipment will eventually be moved out and reused elsewhere. But if West Fraser decides to go that route, it may take a while. Georgia Pacific's paper mill has been on the seller's block since November and it has yet to find a buyer. Meanwhile, the state and county are losing money. According to the UF Institute of Food and Agricultural Science, once the paper mill closed, Taylor County lost $370 million in local spending and was down 2,000 workers. The state missed out on $10 million in tax revenue.
There's a lot of ugly, but there's also a lot of beauty and a lot of opportunity.
Jason Shove, Taylor County's state Republican representative, says he's working to secure jobs for the people impacted by the mill's closure. He is urging state agencies to house some offices in Taylor County to preserve and attract more people to the area.
Even as far as reaching out to groups like Space Florida and trying to find partnerships with industries that are looking for a home with a highly skilled workforce, highly trained, and Taylor County has that.
Shove's efforts come after the legislature recently approved nearly $3 million of the state's budget to go towards the expansion of Perry's Technical College. The program has been providing Floridians with special education and career training in the Big Bend region. It helps create jobs for students entering nursing and engineering fields. I'm Adrian Andrews.
Our regular Capital Report correspondents are Adrian Andrews, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. We also thank Christine DeMonte and Kate Payne. Technical support for Capital Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. We hope you'll join us again next week online and on air for more reports from the state capitol.
Capital Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.